Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I have a soft spot for the format of old radio shows. It's something we're going to be talking about possibly in season two of the podcast. And one of my favorites is suspense. I bet you can tell what that's about. The biggest issue I have listening to them, though, like a lot of media in the past, is that it's full of things we just don't do anymore, or we don't say things that way anymore. Of course, they are full of racist caricatures and sexism. That is to be expected, and some stories are worse than others. And then I went on a deep dive to listen to all of the episodes of Suspense in sequence. And the biggest shock was how many of the mysteries involved, they're crazy, they've gone mad, madness can never be treated and will lead you to your death and the downfall of everyone you love. And for a long time in media, that's how mental health issues and spectrum disorders have been portrayed. It's not particularly sensitive. It's not accurate. Think about how many prestige dramas or textbook thrillers use it as a plot device or a character quirk. Well, let me ask you guys, do you think there is any media out there that is accurate to a mental health experience or even compassionate towards it?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's possible. no, I do think, to me, I think the thing is when people tackle it personally, when people tackle it head on, even biographically, I think it can be so either heavy-handed or there's a temptation to make it into more metaphor than reality. So I think it can be pretty tough. But I find, at least personally, that movies, like especially comedies, which we're pretty much getting into today, can deal with it as an aspect of a story very well. We were kind of talking about favorite ones, and one of my favorites is Richard Ayoade's film Submarine. It's like a coming-of-age movie, but it's also about depression. I think The Skeleton Twins is also very good for that.
Yeah.
And even, like, weirdly, a movie like Honey Boy, which is very deeply about mental health, I think still is kind of about other stuff, and mental health is just an aspect of it. And I think that those are the movies that do it best for me.
Well, if there's anything, I think the reality is it's going to be very recent because, you know, the era of me kind of coming of age and growing up with films like Girl Interrupted were very, I think, poorly done and inaccurate and drama driven and Oscar baity. And those films tend to really set the depiction of spectrum disorders and mental health issues back, I think, a long time. The one that came to my mind, and I really haven't thought this through, is the one that affected me most was probably the TV show Fleabag, just where it's so cerebral and it's so inside her head. And it's not necessarily, like Cam is saying, it's not necessarily about mental health, although everything that motivates her, whether it's sex addiction or grief, the death of her best friend, the loss of her mother, like she is definitely going through the throes of multiple probably mental health crises. You know, that's a very recent one that I think has had a lot of influence probably on films and television and all media to come.
There's a lot of stuff happening in podcasting right now that I really like for nonfiction podcasts like Hilarious World of Depression or Terrible Thanks for Asking, but also in audio dramas, which I love. There's one specific one. It's a horror podcast called The Magnus Archives. I don't want to spoil it too much. It's awesome if you just dive in and let it unfold. But it's this world where there's fears are these big powers. And then underneath the fears, they have these kind of avatars that create chaos. One of those big fears is this concept of the lonely in that you are by yourself and you can't touch other people and other people can't touch you emotionally or physically. And when I heard this, I was like, oh, someone gets how I feel when I'm depressed. And it was a really revelatory, happy sort of feeling. And I think that's what I'm excited about is this
idea that we're now talking about mental health as if it's not just, it's one thing. This is what depression looks like. This is what anxiety looks like. It's very much showing it as a spectrum and that it's a very nuanced sort of thing. And that's going to be represented in the films that we're discussing today.
Mm-hmm. It is not a good sign that I'm tearing up right now. I think this should be a fun
one. But I know what you mean. Another one I thought about as like a good one, but it's like hard to pin down, is Synecdoche, New York, which I think is like, it's like a big metaphor about the feeling of like a lack of control and depression. I think a lot of the good ones, because I mean, also like Melancholia is a great depression movie, but it doesn't end well.
Jesus.
But I think that's what's so fascinating about 2007 is that we were starting to get a handle on mental health stuff. Mm-hmm. And we were starting to be like, okay, we can look at this in different ways where it doesn't have to be a prestige. It doesn't have to be a thriller. It doesn't have to be a negative thing. Yes, it's a challenge to interact socially. And these are movies about social interaction. But they're also funny and warm and charming and lovely, which is why we picked these two movies today. And I'm so glad we did. This movie, the first movie we're going to talk about today, like Alicia's friend Hemnet, who is passing around the DVDs as their calling card of Eyes of Laura Mars, this is my calling card movie. I have made people sit down and watch this so that we could be friends. Mm. It's called Eagle versus Shark. I saw it in the theaters multiple times. I still quote it. I own the DVD and the digital. And it's a look at grief, depression, trauma, unrequited attraction, and spectrum disorders, all stuff we were talking about, but it's also really, really, really funny. And it was written and directed by one of my favorite filmmakers, Taika Waititi, a name you might recognize from, hey, the Marvel Universe now. He's kind of a big deal. And it also is the first introduction to a lot of his buddies that would then proceed to pop up all over North American cinema. I will not take it personally if you guys do not love this movie as much as I do. I'm sure this is a very like love it or hate it sort of one. I think both of the movies we picked for this segment are. And critics sure as heck didn't care for this one.
Critics didn't
love
it.
Cam, what do you think of Eagle versus Shark? Please, please. Our friendship rides on this.
I think it's a very funny movie. I think, it's coming at a time, which I will talk a bit about, where there was kind of two huge Sundance hits, Little Miss Sunshine, which has a lot in common with this, and Napoleon Dynamite. So it's kind of inevitably linked to Napoleon Dynamite because it also is dealing with sort of social outsiders who are weirdos. But the difference is it's quite a harder... Napoleon Dynamite is a lot more lovable than these weirdos. It's a little harder to get into, but kind of by the end of it, I enjoy it. To be fair, I don't have any problems with Napoleon Dynamite, but I think I maybe like it a little more just because it's more of an exploration of why these characters are the way they are, whereas I think Napoleon Dynamite is more just kind of presenting these characters and putting them in a situation.
Napoleon Dynamite's a world where everything is weird. Like, you're just in a weird zone. Whereas this one, it's grounded in reality, but there's just everything slightly more
heightened. To be fair, I have friends from Ohio, which I think is where Napoleon Dynamite is set, who say that it's just a very accurate depiction of Ohio. But that's kind of the interesting thing about Eagle versus Shark, is it ties in all this stuff. I don't even think that I would necessarily... first and foremost call it a mental health movie, but also at the same time it's like it's a film that's dealing with various indigenous issues without seeming to be much of an indigenous film either.
I think if Napoleon Dynamite is an Ohio film, which I've never heard of or thought of, but it makes perfect sense to me, this is definitely very New Zealand.
Yeah, and I mean, that's when you hear Taika Waititi talk about it, that is kind of his main thrust beyond everything else, is to try to represent what he sees as New Zealand humor, as like a very kind of subtle New Zealand humor, which he thought hadn't really gone out to the rest of the world yet. And working with Lauren Horsley on this character, he thought that this was a great way to deliver that kind of humor.
I love her so much. I want more of her. She doesn't do too much film work after this.
She does a lot of stage, from my understanding. She's a predominantly stage actress.
I fell in love with her so quickly, especially her role as this, she works at a burger joint, which I think was based on a real kind of burger joint that Taika Waititi frequented, that are only known to New Zealand. Or maybe it was a chicken restaurant, I think.
Okay, we haven't done this yet, so I just want to do a quick plot summary. As you mentioned, Lauren Horsley plays a character called Lily, who works at a burger joint. joint, and she has a massive crush on this character, Jared, played by Jemaine Clement, who talks a big game about how cool and accomplished he is, but he's a real jerk to Lily and the people around him, and he's not as good at things as he may say he is. But he and Lily end up in a kind of one-sided romantic relationship. She follows him back to his hometown, where he's going to confront his childhood bully in a fight that he's been training for. And while Lily is there, she meets his family, uncovers a bunch of the lies he's told her, and grows out of this blind attraction and naivete that she was kind of carrying around with her. And he gets a little bit of a wake-up call and a shock, too. This movie really works because Lauren Horsley's character of Lily is just so empathetic.
Just, oh gosh, she's so earnest and so sweet and so unliked by everyone around her except for her lovely brother. And both of their parents have passed, so they're all they really have is each other. And that is probably the best part of this film, is that strong relationship.
And they don't ever let it get them down. And that's the thing you can't help but love about the Lauren Horsley character, is no matter how many terrible things happen to her, and terrible things happen, and she's not stupid, she just keeps going. And she's like, because that's what you got to do. You just keep going. And that's just so inspirational to see.
Yeah, she goes through the motions. Like, she suffers grief throughout the film, and the realization that the person that she has a crush on, which is an asshole. Like, we've all, you know, in high school or even adulthood, we've all worshipped and had crushes on these people that turn out to be really horrible when they figure out that they can treat you any way that they want, and you probably will not leave. And so this sounds very grim, but with Taika Waititi's quirkiness, I think it plays very, very well. And I found myself really relating to it, even though it's like very much stuck in this kind of fantasy world of like there's stop motion animation at certain points. There's a music video at certain points. It's very much, if you're a fan of Flight of the Conchords, which my God, am I a fan of Flight of the Conchords.
Yep.
This and Taika Waititi, of course, directed a couple episodes per season of that and helped develop it, I think. You know, this is a good film for you.
It's basically simultaneously produced with Flight of the Conchords, for my understanding. They were going back and forth. So let's go back to Taika Waititi himself, because I don't think a lot of people know his journey and that he was Oscar nominated very early in his career.
What you need to know. Let's go back. New Zealand was born out of volcanic flames. No.
Then there were hobbits.
Yeah, exactly. The New Zealand film industry is kind of a unique one. It's very interesting. I think something notable with this movie is that the first Maori film written and directed by Maori people was only in 1987.
Jeez.
So think that this is about 20 years after that. New Zealand film was going through a big boom at the time, of course, partially thanks to Lord of the Rings, which was an canny investment by Peter Jackson, making everything shot in his home country and with crews. So suddenly there was all this money and all these very talented crews all of a sudden. And also a big interest in Maori stories, thanks to Nicky Caro's Whale Rider, which featured a lot of big actors. Some of the actors you see here, like Rachel House.
He
was a short filmmaker. He was a comedian. He had a comedy troupe that was quite successful, involved in various things. He started making short films.
Can we just say that it was called Humor Beast, which delights me? And it was with Jemaine Clement.
I also feel like it had 100 different names. It seems like, I can't tell if he was in a bunch of different things or just one troupe that kept changing.
They're very creative people, Cam. I get it.
Yes. He ended up teaming up with Ainsley Gardner, who's a Maori producer. And she eventually teamed up with her cousin, who is actor Cliff Curtis, who a lot of people might know from Once Were Warriors and various American action movies. He kind of came over with Lee Tamahari in the 90s. And they wanted to produce more indigenous stories. She read his scripts and really loved them. They ended up producing two very big shorts together, Two Cars, One Night and Tama Tu won Sundance, and he was Oscar nominated for Two Cars, One Night, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, so those were two kind of huge shorts.
When he was nominated for the Oscars, this was one of the first years that they were actually panning the audience for like the Oscar moments, where they like cut to people in the audience and like, you know, you do a high five or like a smile.
Mistake on the Oscars part.
Well, Taika thought it would be hilarious if he could get everybody together in his section and all of them pretend to be asleep. And it seemed like everybody was on board.
I thought they were serious. I thought they were into it. And they, I was the only one who did it. But I realized, I was looking at the screen, I was like, oh, they're not doing it. No one's doing it. And it's getting closer to me. And I thought, fuck, I'm going to do it. I don't care. And I did it.
Which, this is Taika Waititi in 2000. So the film is from 2004. The Academy Awards ceremony is 2005. Like, this is a long time ago. This is 15 years ago. Now we all, like, he's so omnipresent.
Yeah, now you would expect him to be asleep.
Yeah, and, like, he's so, you exactly. know, he's like a heartthrob. But this is not the Taika Waititi of 2005. So it would have been, I think the producers of the Oscars were quite cantankerous. And apparently, Becky, you told me that New Zealand was, like, slapping him on the wrist. Like, how dare you?
He got a big slap on the wrist from New Zealand because they were like, yeah, this is, like, our chance on the world stage. And you did this? Yeah, so it was. It actually, from what I understand, may or may not have affected some of his opportunities in funding for doing that.
Yeah. Well, listen, he showed them by winning an Oscar.
And I have to say, I watched Two Cars one night, actually yesterday, and it's beautiful. It's black and white. It's if you are a fan of his films, the two that I would really, or if you're not, and you're looking for something outside of the Marvel universe or What We Do in the Shadows, Boy and Hunt for the Wilder People, you can't go wrong. And those are films where you see, like in his short Two Cars One Night, he directs children and people on the spectrum in a way that is like so wonderful. I really love this short. You can see it online. And then the next year, Tama 2 is, I don't think people would realize, but it's a World War II film. Mm-hmm. So it's about a battalion of Maori soldiers that fought in World War II. And I saw it when TIFF presented their indigenous, one of the largest indigenous filmmaking retrospectives up to that point in 2013. And they included all of Taika's shorts. And Tama 2 was such a theatrical film. It was incredible. So as much as maybe he didn't get as many opportunities after pissing off the Academy Awards and all of New Zealand, he still was churning out these shorts up until the point of Eagle versus Shark in 2007 that were pretty wildly successful.
Would Tama 2 be in, like, an indication that he was capable of doing a Marvel movie? Because you kind of look at his stuff and he's got like a lot of indie comedies, very quirky, very small. So Tama 2 would be like, yeah, this guy can handle a bigger set piece.
Yeah, he filmed it in a recently imploded Wellington factory or something, like department store, I can't remember. So he made that look like the rubble of World War II in Europe. I believe it was Europe. It's been so long since I've seen it, and it's not super available. It's been a solid 7 or 8 years. But there's special effects. There's, you know, it's about it. But it's also a very interpersonal drama about, you know, the shared culture of these Maori soldiers that no one gives credit to in World War II histories. I think we feel similar to that with our Canadian history in World War I and World War II. But yeah, I would say that that's definitely an indication that he was, you know, this very short film that I believe is like 10 or 12 minutes, was about to handle 20 years later, these incredibly high budget films. Getting to go to Sundance a number of times and see his films at Sundance, where he was like the hottest filmmaker, but still the public hadn't caught on yet, is some of the happiest memories of my life. It's like being at the premiere of Hunt for the Wilder People with Sam Neill and Taika and his child actor. And it was just like, first of all, the most hilarious Q&A you could ever imagine, but also just a very magical experience. And then seeing where he is now is just like, well, it all makes sense. And it makes sense when you watch Eagle versus Shark. I watch this and I see as a feature debut, I see it. I absolutely see it revisiting this film because, like you, I saw this early when it came out and I absolutely loved it. I have a little bit more hesitation today, just slightly, with how it deals with the Jemaine Clement character.
Agreed.
But I think this is a wonderful film.
Yeah, it's interesting too when you talk about these shorts and like kind of his the interest in him is that Boy, as you said, is very close to Two Cars One Night, and it's really a feature adaptation of Two Cars One Night, and he was working on it, but nobody was really that interested in it, so that's why they switched over to Eagle versus Shark to come between them, because it kind of hits more, like I say, that Napoleon Dynamite tone, and the year before was The Foot Fist Way by Jody Hill, which is kind of the same sort of tonally thing. And it also, there's interestingly just like a movement of these sort of non-rom-com things, you know, like Me, You, and Everyone We Know and Wrist Cutters and stuff like that, like these indie sort of responses to the glossy 90s rom-com. So it's interesting that he chose, was chosen for him. The only path forward was this more unusual film rather than the one that was tackling indigenous issues more head on.
More people went to see Boy upon its premiere, which I believe Boy is like 2009. then they went and saw Jurassic Park in 1992. Like, and it still holds a lot of records in the New Zealand box office.
Yeah, he's still, I believe, the highest grossing director.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
One of the things I like so much about him, though, is that he really does take these character actors along with him. So it's like, you know, a David Bowie kicking open the door for Iggy Pop and Lou Reed and being like, hey, I'm famous. Now you guys are famous, too. And he writes parts for them. And they're just so much fun. And they're so lovely. So in this one, you get Rachel House.
Oh, I love her so much. She's so phenomenal.
Adore her. She's so funny. She has that giant smile. And in this one, she is playing Jemaine Clement's character. Sister, who
the biggest asshole,
who is so obsessed with multi-level marketing schemes, and so every time Lauren and every time she walks in, they have a new multi-level marketing scheme that they're trying to sell her. So like they're standing there with knives and smiling. They're wearing these like amazing tracksuits.
She's the Cutco knife woman of New Zealand, or like Mary Kay, or in the, the tracksuits are probably the best. Where, you know, their business selling tracksuits door to door from the 90s didn't take off, so she just keeps offloading them on. Poor Lauren Horsley. But they're very, I mean, today those tracksuits would be very
everyone
coveted. This fashion has come back. I will say, just talking about the tracksuits and all the people that he's, you know, brought up through the New Zealand film industry, I love this film for its level of detail. And I think, Becky, you mentioned this too. And I was just, I wrote down some of the things that were in the background. I know you have a couple, but like, when he goes, I think it's when it's his apartment where he has his costume party where he dresses up as a shark. Or sorry, he dresses up as an eagle and Lauren Horsley's character dresses up as shark. That's why it's eagle versus shark. There's a dog's playing poker blanket hung up like a tapestry that I just think is, I want to know where it came from. If Taika like found it, if it's his, like, as I know it was populated with a lot of like actual props from their lives. And it's, I just love that level of detail.
It's one of the best introductions to a character I think I've ever seen, because there's a sex scene where instead of cutting to the curtains, they pan around his room for like 15 seconds and then it's over. But it's just such an incredible concept of, this is how you explain who this person is and what they love. You know, he makes very inappropriate candles as one of his hobbies. And like, he's just such a fascinating human being who is a jerk, but it does make some excuses for why he is the way he is. He just hasn't processed it as well as Lauren Horsley's character has.
He's in a state of arrested development, which I think someone, and he's in a state of grief as well. His older brother has committed suicide.
Played by Taika Waititi, who's meant to be this perfect character.
and when we say played by Taika Waititi, it's done very cleverly, where he's never in the film's world. He's only in the film's world through photographs, like family photographs, which I can't imagine how fun were to stage. And then his father keeps watching this video of his deceased son winning a marathon. So he's in like archival video and photo frames. And that said, he doesn't appear elsewhere. And it's a very gentle nod, which I think is done quite well.
I think one of the things I also loved about this, because I remember very distinctly when I saw this in 2007, the audience going almost silent, and this is a spoiler, go watch the movie, of when he's confronting his bully, and he discovers that his bully is actually in a wheelchair. He was in an accident, and he is now a paraplegic. And instead, he apologizes to the Jemaine Clement character and says, look, I'm sorry I did this to you, and I'm sorry I made you feel this way. And then there's like this pause, and in a normal North American movie, you'd be like, okay, this is the feel good moment where he realizes what this is. He attacks him with nunchucks.
And also arguably gets his ass kicked by the guy in the wheelchair, even without his legs. That guy beats him up
and
pretty good.
Just remember the audience being dead silent for like 10 seconds after that happened, totally unsure how to process it, and then just killing themselves laughing, right? And you're just like, what happened?
That's New Zealand humor. Yeah. If I had to like say like what is the essence, it's that inappropriateness, that lack of sentimentality, and that just cutthroatness. That's not a word. Ability to be so cutthroat in its comedy, which you do see, I think, in Flight of the Conchords, and you see in What We Do in the Shadows. You know, this is a film. We should say Jemaine Clement's character is also a father, which is a very interesting component. And this child that they hired to play his daughter is the cutest kid I've ever seen.
She's got the Little Miss Sunshine vibe.
Did you see that it was written as a man, and then he loved that little girl so much, he just swapped it.
Because
he was like, she is too good. But yeah, there's when he talks about the like New Zealand humor, he's definitely, like he says, it's the super weirdly subtle stuff. So I think he was very obsessed with Lily, for instance, being a completely repulsive character. They apparently, the best anecdote they have is they got her to go in character through Park City during a Sundance. And he said that people parted like the Red Sea because she was so off-putting.
Okay, she's really pretty. So Lauren Parsley is very, very attractive. Like, very intelligent. This is also Taika Waititi's partner, romantic partner at the time, we should say. Like, I do want to say, like, she's it's such a credit to the film and to Taika and to even Jemaine Clement in how they treat her character, because that would have taken a lot of work to make her that unattractive and unappealing, because she's, I think, a very lovely and an appealing person. I want to say,
but she would have been. Yeah.
It's Park City is a weird place where unless you are super attractive and like wearing the most expensive Canada Goose jacket, which I guess wasn't around in 2007, you are ignored, such as myself.
And I mean, I will also say that part of her character that he said was developed is that she will always treat people nice and kind and be good to them, and people are always going to be shit to
that's
her.
Repulsive at Sundance. That's not what you want at Sundance.
No.
You want
to be.
This also has one of the most ingenious Save the Cat moments at the very beginning I think I've ever seen. So Save the Cat, for people who aren't sure, is a technical term for, like, you have to have someone do something good at the beginning so that you know they're the hero, and then you follow them. You save the cat out of the tree, whatever. This one is, you immediately understand how lonely she is, because it's her talking into the mirror proposing a date to herself about being her own boyfriend. And she's just so happy in that moment. And it is so endearing and so lovely that you're like, yeah, I'm 100% on board with this human being. She's so wonderful.
It's also heartbreaking.
It's exactly. It rides that line so beautifully of being so sad and so endearing and so wonderful simultaneously. Again, this is not a movie everybody's going to love. Some people are going to watch this.
No.
I'm going to get added and being like, I feel like
we can turn them, though. I feel like people who maybe didn't have seen this and didn't love it, I hope that they might review this. I love that you love this film so much, Becky.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those movies I really want more people to see, even if they hate it.
Yes,
it's just,
that was apparent.
It's just
it
such an unusual little treasure, little gem that's just got so much in it. And I just have such respect, as you said earlier, Alicia, for the details of, like, the consistency of so many things. So, like, in the background of Jared's apartment, there's a little note that says, "You owe $257. Stop calling Samoa!" Exclamation point.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I love it.
I guess he's called Samoa.
And his roommates.
Yes.
And the guy, I think the guy
the
that
bully
he wants
lives
to fight
in
is in Samoa. Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, we talked about how the critics weren't totally sure how they felt about this one, because it's pretty freaking weird. But our next one was more critically acclaimed. In fact, it got nominated for an Oscar for writing. And it was a year that was stacked for writing noms for women. And so Nancy Oliver was researching an article for a magazine, and she stumbled upon realdoll.com. And her brain wheels got turning about who would order an anatomically correct sex doll. And so instead of making a movie about a perverted killer or a gross-out comedy about how weird that was, which, let's face it, is the direction most people would have gone, Nancy Oliver asked a bunch of different questions. Alicia, you love this. Like, I love Eagle versus Shark. Let's talk Lars and the Real Girl.
Yeah, I saw this when it came out and I loved it then. But I have to say, in prepping this podcast episode, I was very concerned that a rewatch would make it sort of lesser in my eyes. I wasn't sure that this film had aged well in 13 years. And for me anyway, and I don't know if Cam feels this way or you do, Becky, it actually it's gotten better. And I don't entirely understand how, but I loved rewatching this film. I loved it so much. Nancy Oliver, people who are interested in her work, she would be very well known for having written episodes of 6 Feet Under. And if there were a tone that I would say this film really strikes, it is a 6 Feet Under kind of tone, which is probably why I love it so much. It is about how Ryan Gosling plays a loner who lives on the property of his brother. Well, because it's formerly his parents' property. He lives in a garage. He has very few friends, but he's a functional... I don't want to, like, give a term. He might be on the spectrum. He might be suffering depression. It might be both. But he's functional. He goes to work. He functions. But he does see that his brother, whose wife is pregnant, is moving on with his life, and he is not. So, and everyone in the town, they live in a... It's supposed to be Minnesota,
I think,
right?
It's Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. Yep, Wisconsin. Spoiler alert, it's definitely like King City, Elora, Alton. It's all around Ontario. Yep. But it's meant to be like in a very like kind of isolated, very cold, wintry town. So, you know, townspeople just stick together and they get married and you have kids and that's your life. And he hasn't done that. And everyone always keeps asking him, like, when are you going to start dating?
Everyone seems obsessed with his dating life. Yes. Every scene,
yeah,
they're like, did you meet
somebody? He's young and attractive and hasn't dated. And so that's really alarming for people. And I think if he lived in a city, it wouldn't be. But it is a circumstance of his location. And so he just shows up with a sex doll. And it's one of the anatomically correct sex dolls. They were called Real Dolls, which was a real thing. Nancy Oliver, the screenwriter, found the website in 2002 and was fascinated by how customizable and detailed, very expensive. We're talking thousands of dollars for these dolls. And I think most of us probably remember when these kind of came up on the market. And they all had backstories, you know, like, you know, she's a secretary by day, going to school at night and just wants to have a good time. Like there was like a full like rundown of who they were. And he orders one named Bianca. And Bianca shows up and he tells his brother and sister that, you know, he's got a new girlfriend, but, you know, she's in a wheelchair. She doesn't talk a lot. English is her second language. She's a missionary. And then lo and behold, he wheels her in and it's the sex doll. And so clearly he's having a mental health crisis. But the town, to their credit, the town, his brother and sister-in-law and the whole town decide that he needs this. And there's a doctor played by Patricia Clarkson, who's both a psychologist and the family doctor, who says, like, we have to help him through this. And ostracizing him or committing him, which is actually discussed very early on, is not necessarily going to help him. Understanding will. And eventually, Bianca becomes a fully realized member of her community. And we're probably in this episode going to talk about her as though she's a real person. And that's how she was treated on set.
It's very, very fascinating how much thought went into this.
It's amazing. We'll talk about that in a bit. But she really becomes part of his story. And he has to work through his issues with her as his girlfriend. They fight. There's some jealousy. He brings her to parties. There is a way that this film could have been so condescending and so maladaptive and so cruel, and it never, ever goes there.
I think Ryan Gosling talking about why he wanted to do the project underlines why this movie's so special.
I think that the script and Nancy as a writer, I think it's kind of a radical movie in the sense that it has like the guts to be nice and to wear its heart on its sleeve and to be totally exposed.
I was reading a review from Roger Ebert who said, you know, its weapon is absolute sincerity. It has a kind of purity to it. And I think that that's an important thing if you're going to have a film about sort of an undiagnosed mental illness.
The thing that I believe you keep waiting for, the expectation is that something bad is going to happen to Bianca and it's going to break the Ryan Gosling character. It's going to break Lars. And that never happens. And he's the one who comes to his own realization at the end of what works best for him in a scene that is, frankly, heartbreaking and wonderful.
I was crying. I cried in 2007. I cried in 2020. So.
Again, this is a movie that you're either going to absolutely love, totally hate. I think critics were kind of on the same fence. Some people found it like way too whimsical, way too twee. Mm-hmm. I think it rides the right side of that because nothing bad does happen. It's more of a character exploration.
Nancy Oliver says that when she wrote it, it was very much, she was like, I want to write a fantasy where everyone does the right thing.
Mm.
Everyone
yeah,
treats each other decently and does the correct thing.
Yeah,
and
kindness is a fantasy.
Yes, which is
very
sad.
Upsetting.
Especially, and yeah, she said that especially she wanted to do it surrounding mental health. Like everyone treats you the right way that you should. But it is interesting because in development, you do hear that there was a scene where he got mocked that they shot. And the interesting thing is the director, Craig Gillespie, says that every scene that did go too far just couldn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting. I'm kind of fascinated to know what the real shooting script was like. Nancy Oliver is also like, she's, I assume, relatively sex positive because she was involved in one of the only erotic mainstream video games ever produced called Rihanna Rouge. It was a porn star produced her own video game, but it was distributed through Konami. It's the only, feminist. It's very forward thinking. It's kind of a woman tries to stop a rape and gets killed, maybe, but then she gets transported to like a heavy metal universe where she's like a dominatrix kind of navigating evil kings and stuff. But it's kind of famous just because there weren't many adults-only video games. But I think that she was interested in the sexual aspect. And Craig Gillespie, yeah, says that they did remove some of that. And there's a few leftover scenes. There's a scene where Ryan Gosling gets in the tub with Bianca. But even that, he's like, it just can't. Like, for some reason, they just stuck out like a sore thumb. Everything that went slightly dark or slightly, you know, more real out of this kind of fantasy bubble just didn't work.
I think part of it too is that they do such a good job of making Bianca real to the audience and a character, and the doll itself had, I believe, 9 different faces, which essentially were acted as like different kinds of makeup. So she starts sort of as a sex doll where she's wearing heavy makeup, and as she morphs throughout the film, you see her more vulnerable and kind of eventually Bianca gets sick, which is how the film is resolved. And they did such a good job of making the audience really see, like, she, like, and her body language too. You can position the doll in a different way to, you know, posturing, which gives a different sense of, you know, this character. And Becky, you're the one who told me that she, I think I read about this too, but they, on set, they treated her as though she was an actress. She had a trailer. She was dressed privately. She wasn't, it wasn't like in between takes, they're stripping her off and putting the next costume on. She was treated with dignity in a way that, you know, I mean, I love in the film at one point, he's not being very nice to her. He's like really jealous because she got voted onto the school board.
she's too busy for him.
Yeah. And he's just like, what is it? And then you see them yelling in a car. And one of the townspeople who's kind of helping her, she just like points her finger at him. And he's like, she's like, I don't like your tone. She has her own life. And I was just like, this. How did this film do this?
Yeah.
I was mad too at how he treated her. I was just like, you know, because she's characterized early in the film as sort of challenged and has possibly a disability. And the fact is she's a sex doll, but that would explain why she doesn't walk. And the thing is, you know, she gets her own life and her own friends, and she gets a job at the mall. Literally, she gets a job at the mall selling clothing. And like, I'm happy for her. It's so crazy.
Well, there's also press junkets where they would actually, Ryan Gosling and Bianca would go to the junkets together, and he would speak to her and then would pause as if she was responding to the question as well, and then would respond to what she just said. So there's a whole thing going on here. We should actually probably talk about Ryan Gosling and his commitment to character. He lived on set.
I believe that. Yeah, with no heat, basically.
Spent like a week. I don't think he did the whole time, but it sounds like he lived quite a bit. And I also love the fact that this is one of the times that, you know, we all know the famous story of him showing up for the Lovely Bones, having gained a lot of weight and a weird mustache and immediately being
60
fired.
60 pounds. He gained 60 pounds without being
asked. Just drank ice cream. And he admits that he was losing his mind at that point. And that was crazy. But this, he did the same thing. They asked him to do nothing. And he showed up on set with a crazy mustache and had gained weight. But luckily in this time, Craig Gillespie's like, damn, that really works. That works a lot, and it makes you just more like cuddly and lovable.
And I noticed the studio was really frustrated because they were like, he's a heartthrob. I mean, come on.
Well, the notebook, right? It was the notebook.
Yeah,
he was off the notebook.
The notebook was his most famous thing.
And they really wanted him to lose the mustache. They were like, okay, we understand why he gained 20 or 30 pounds, I guess. He's still like such an attractive man in this film.
Yeah.
But he put his foot down. He's like, the mustache is a is a milestone of this character. And I mean, it's true. Like, the mustache works so well, as does the off-brand vintage Patagonia puffer jacket, which is now very fashionable.
Great
today.
Sweaters throughout as well. Everybody's got a good sweater on.
Yeah.
The other thing I think I really love about this, bringing into the reality, is that it's one of the first portrayals of families reacting to mental health that I think I've seen. So, for example, the brother, his first reaction, as Alicia pointed out when we were talking earlier, was, how do I pay for this? Because American medical system. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is this sense of shame of what are people going to think? How do we protect him, and how do we protect ourselves if he's having this breakdown? It's very accurate. And one of the main reasons why people, two of the main reasons why people don't get help addressed in that way.
There's a part where he actually, the brother types in, it's 2007, so he types into ask.com mental illness and just starts like looking at the links and his eyes just go super wide. And it's true, like this is 13 years ago. We've hopefully come a long way with how we treat mental illness, but it was a lot more grim in 2007. Like we're exponentially having to pick up on all the time we've wasted stigmatizing mental illness.
Yeah, and I think there's a very good, like my favorite, maybe my favorite moment in the whole movie, though there's a lot of good moments. I think Patricia Clarkson is so good as the doctor
She's
just kind of so straightforward. But there's a great part where she's fighting with Paul Schneider, who also is amazing. Like everybody, you know, they wanted Emily Mortimer from the start. And you're like, yeah, this is Emily Mortimer, what she's good at. But there's a part where Paul Schneider, they're arguing about, essentially, Patricia Clarkson says everyone needs to treat Bianca like she's real. And Paul Schneider's like, we can't do that. They're all going to laugh at him. And she goes, and you. Which is like so good. Because she's line. Just saying, she's like getting to the point of it that, yeah, so much of people's reluctance to deal with their family members who have mental illness is that they're embarrassed for themselves. They don't want people to talk about them.
A lot of this is about the brother. You know, their parents. So there's a bit of an age difference between two brothers. And you know, the mother died while Lars was very young, and he was left with his grieving father while Paul Schneider's character went off to college.
Oh, the mother died in childbirth.
Oh, fuck, you're right. My God. And so that's why Lars is having this mental crisis in a lot of ways, because his sister-in-law is pregnant, and he's equated that pregnancy equals death, especially childbirth equals death, and it's his fault. And so I've forgotten about that. Thank you, Cam.
Yeah.
So he's really having some struggles, but it's a lot of the brother confronting, you know, how he's never really repaired that relationship with his brother. He has to apologize, saying like, I left you with a mentally ill man and I went off and lived my life and got married and I'm happy and you live in the garage. Like he literally lives in the garage because they live in their parents' former house and they built him an apartment in the garage. And it's just, everyone has to confront their own ideas of what mental health is in the film, not just Lars, but even like the townspeople.
Yeah. And so much of Paul Schneider's thing is they have found a detente where like he's likes Lars living in the garage and being a kind of weird guy and not dealing with it. And that's kind of why they were so interested in Emily Mortimer for the character, because she doesn't have a huge arc, but her whole thing is just, she is the one who's like, I can't stand your brother living in the garage anymore. I must get him to come to breakfast.
She literally tackles him at one point, which I love.
Pregnant tackles him in the snow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I also think a lot about the film Harvey from 1950, which if you haven't seen Harvey, it's a pretty famous classic film. It stars Jimmy Stewart as someone who has an imaginary, I believe he's a 9-foot rabbit.
He's a functional alcoholic, but they don't actually say that, do they?
That's true. Okay. Yeah, he drinks a lot. Well, I mean, the rabbit's an alcoholic, I think. And then he's just, Harvey's just keeping him company at the bar is my understanding of that situation. And I love Harvey. I would really recommend it, but it's, you know, his family has a lot of shame, and if we're talking about mental health, let me tell you, mental health in 1950 was those two words didn't even go together. That was not two words put in the same sentence.
Just crazy.
Yeah.
I see a lot of Harvey in Lars and the Real Girl. And I also see a lot of like Preston Sturges, like the absurdity and but the sincerity and the tolerance is all there.
Yeah. I think also if you like movies like this, an interesting thing to look for, it doesn't always come up, but there's this weird award called the Humanitas Prize, which is for art that depicts humanity in a meaningful way. And Lars and the Real Girl won it alongside The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is kind of an interesting dual match. But if you like these movies that kind of explore the aspects of, like you say, and I think it quite often involves religion and loving one another. But yeah, always look up what won the Humanitas Prize. It's kind of an unusual thing.
Unusual is certainly the word to describe the two romances in the movies we just talked about, and possibly in the two next movies we're going to talk about after the break. So when we come back, did you know that chipmunks don't have eyebrows? It's why you never know what they're thinking. So they had to be added onto a CGI chipmunk character in one of the movies we're going to be talking about. That's coming up after the break. In the A Year in Film series, we know that the historical context in which movies are made matters. And you can't argue that one of the biggest influences into North American culture, be it from the lives it affected and cut short to the fictional movies made about their reign of terror, is Charles Manson and the Manson family. Now, if you're like me and you are number one, a nerd for true crime, and number two, fascinated by how a group of individuals could affect culture so deeply, check out the definitive 6-part docuseries Helter Skelter, An American Myth. And Hollywood Suite is the only place you're going to be able to catch it in Canada.
Part One airs February 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and every Thursday until the season finale on March 18th. And the episodes drop on demand the day after the premiere. So if you're listening to this podcast in the future, the whole series may just be available to binge right now. That's Helter Skelter, An American Myth, starting February 11th to give new context to the way you watch movies.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When I say the words Disney princess, what pops up for you? A protagonist innocent in the ways of the world as evil outside forces conspire against them, women with giant eyes singing to animals, a wholesome happily ever after. People love these movies, and they create their own artistic interpretations of Disney princesses all the time as things like zodiac signs or posing for mugshots, which is very weird and a little disturbing. But our obsession with all things royalty doesn't stop at Disney. 2007 saw an event that rocked the tabloids. I'm talking rocked. Prince William and Kate Middleton broke up for a whole 3 months. Guys, who cares? Genuinely, who cares? But why do we care about this so much?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I think it's always a dream. The dream of being swept up into the royalty somehow. It's just fairy tale stuff. Probably, I don't know, you want my cynical take? It's probably like, people come up with this to make capitalism seem fine. And that we'll always think that there's a chance to escape the constant grind of work and, you know, probably back in the day being a serf. Maybe some prince will love you, but yeah.
You know, I remember being a kid that they were like really trying to push William as the heartthrob. He was in all the teen magazines. He was in Tiger Beat. He had those spreads. He was one of the people who made those like little like page boy caps worn backwards at the Canadian Olympics, like a big thing. They were trying to make him a fashion icon.
Yeah, I also think, I mean, Harry was just too much of a screw up even as a young man. They were afraid of Harry.
But Kate Middleton really was this plucked from obscurity, even though her parents were multimillionaires and she had a stunning education. And she's going to live this dream. And they did the same thing to Diana. And there's this whole narrative of you too could be plucked from obscurity. And now you're a princess for whatever that means.
Yeah, I know. Grace Kelly, you know, they're all out there.
So much disdain for the royal family.
Like, well, I think we're all also past our sell-by date when it comes to royal people marrying us.
Yeah, I guess so.
You'd think by like 2007, because a lot of people grew up with this Disney concept of what being a princess was, that they were going to like swoop in and take care of you and everything was going to be okay. If you're going to subvert that, how do you go about that? Do you do a gender swap on the main character? Do you add a swashbuckling cross-dressing pirate? How about a rapidly decaying Michelle Pfeiffer? Because 2007 saw the release of a movie that could have easily fit into the Disney storytelling tradition, but it was based on like a way darker story by everyone's favorite goth uncle, Neil Gaiman. The adaptation loses some of the original story's darkness. It was a graphic novel and then it was a novel. And the messaging was about the pursuit of beauty and immortality and the dangers within that. And it ends in a very different way than the movie does. But the movie makes up for that in looking at partner compatibility, coming into your own. This is another movie that I genuinely love and have no idea why more people don't know about. I think 2007 actually might be my favorite year for all the movies that we've done. But I want to know how this movie got made at the budget it did with this cast. This thing is wild.
Yeah, Stardust, a very unusual high-budget fantasy film. I mean, to be honest, we'll go through it probably time and time again in a year in film. Just about every time a fantasy movie gets made, it's unusual. Fantasy is a genre that when it hits, it's huge. But it's shocking that even something as big as Lord of the Rings did not really create a boom in fantasy films. Mm-hmm. People are afraid because you invest a hell of a lot of money and so many of them flop. I don't know that this one really counts as a flop. It's kind of on the bubble. It did not make the money they probably wished it would. But
it didn't get the sequel. They wanted to do a sequel. That's why they left it the way that they did, but it did not get the sequel.
Yeah, so, but I think it's like well-liked and it made fine money. And it is also, I think it's like incredibly British in a way that may turn off certain North American viewers. You know, it happens. We are all Anglophiles in this podcast, but many people are not as into it. Yeah, it's a film partially, I think, why it was able to be made at the budget and the size of what it is partially because Neil Gaiman was heavily involved. It was originally The Rice War with Miramax. He eventually learned to not trust that and waited for them to lapse and then guarded them like a maniac and wouldn't let anyone near. Young upstart filmmaker Matthew Vaughn, who actually is a very rare case of somebody who started off as a producer and then became a director.
That's a good point.
He was Guy Ritchie's producer, so he was responsible for a lot of incredibly low budget huge hits. So, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, a lot of those movies Matthew Vaughn was involved in. And he had a massive hit with his first film, Layer Cake, which a lot of people remember as kind of the first big Daniel Craig film. But he wanted to be a writer-director, and he was interested in finding a project. He, much like Neil Gaiman, I think is a very specific guy. You see him gladly turn his fingers up to things and walk away. He left right before this film. He left X-Men The Last Stand, the third X-Men film, partially because they were pushing him to make it too quickly, and he didn't think he could make it to the quality he wanted to make it. So he bailed. He says family reasons, if you look it up. But there's a heavy implication that he also is like, oh, this is going to be bad. So he left. So he was looking for a project to make that would be important and interesting. He really loved the book. He kind of wasn't sure he knew how to crack it, but he was friends with Neil Gaiman. It sounds like they had a personal relationship. So Neil Gaiman trusted him. He trusted them. Neil Gaiman set him up with his friend Jane Goldman, partially because Matthew Vaughn was concerned he wouldn't be able to figure out the romance angles. Mm. Sounds like a lot of the changes, I haven't read the book, but from what you tell me, a lot of the changes actually are to the romance angles, and a lot of kind of the interesting stuff that's added is probably there. And he and Jane Goldman have gone on to be collaborators for almost the rest of his entire career. Yeah, it's a very kind of significant thing. So all these people coming together, and basically Matthew Vaughn being this trusted guy that everyone was kind of after because they know he's pretty good and pretty money-makey, and he knows how to put together a big movie. Like, from here on out, it's all X-Men movies and Kingsman, Kick-Ass. He's a guy who mostly does these kind of extravaganzas. I think that that's why people were confident to give it such a huge budget. And the actors, honestly, he went after huge actors, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robert De Niro. I mean, yeah, it's a stacked cast. Pretty much everyone from those Guy Ritchie films shows up in a short role, usually to get murdered. But yeah, it's a very interesting cast. So I think you can see how from the outside people would be like, oh, this is going to make a kabillion dollars.
I want to take us just quickly into Neil Gaiman and his adaptations, because he's just such a fascinating individual. And he's one of those guys like Stephen King and, of course, like Whitley Strieber, where, like, as soon as his stuff started coming out, people were like, we need to make these into movies. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with Neil Gaiman is that a lot of his stuff would be incredibly expensive to adapt, if not almost impossible. They've been trying to make a Sandman movie or TV show or whatever since the graphic novels came out.
It's on its way, finally, apparently. They're shooting it.
So you say, Kim.
No, it's literally being shot. I know somebody editing it.
It's like Don Quixote, right? Yeah, like it's trying to make that same thing. It's a tilting at windmills. But like this went back all the way to Neverwhere, because Neverwhere, he gave it to the BBC. He wrote the treatment for it and gave it to the BBC. And then the BBC made their like total cock up, I'm going to use the British term, of that story. And he hated it so much, he then wrote a novel to show what it should be. So the novel weirdly came after the TV show adaptation.
Still a pretty good show, I'll say. I don't mind it.
No, it is one of my favorite books of his. Yeah. Like it's very, again, very dark because it's Neil Gaiman. But with Stardust, he still had it in his head that like you needed to tell stories in their entirety, and it was tough for him to figure out what to cut. Mm-hmm. And so Stardust was turned into a radio play first that was 10 and a half hours long. And he was like, oh, if you're making a feature of this, obviously some stuff's got to come out. And by the time the film was ready to come out, Neil Gaiman, on the promotional trail at San Diego Comic-Con, was making statements that he felt like the story had kind of found the right place it needed to be in for the movie.
If you've read the book, you're definitely going to feel very, very at home in the film.
Cool.
There is stuff that is going to surprise you. There is stuff that we simply couldn't do in the way we did it in the book. If we did it in the way we did it in the book, the hero would not be born until you are half an hour into the film. This would be a problem, especially in today's fast-moving world.
And I will say, the movie is even like five movies in one movie. I would not fault somebody being like, there is too much going on. It absolutely could be streamlined.
I really liked it, but one of my notes was, this needs trimming. Like, but it's still excellent.
Yeah, and every performance is so fun. You kind of don't mind, going back to Ricky Gervais as the weird guy, or, you know. Yeah. For instance, I think that the role that Michelle Pfeiffer has is very small in the novel. But they made her kind of a through character throughout, and she's great.
Oh, she's the best in this. She's like, the best part of this.
So good.
If you like Kingsman and the Secret Circle, this is going to be your way to get in, because it is, again, like a bunch of different warring campaigns going against one central unit. And so it's got that same kind of mystique to it, I guess. So the premise of this film is that there's this like British world where there's two sides of this wall. There's the town in like the world we live in, and then there's the town in like this magical world where like there's sky pirates and witches and magic is real.
It's just all fantasy stuff.
It's very Neil Gaiman in his if you cross this border, now you're in a different realm. And like 90% of his novels are about that, right?
Yeah.
And so the shooting star falls. The shooting star ends up being a woman. There's a young man who's like our Disney princess style character who believes he's in love with this other woman played by a very young Sienna Miller.
From Layer Cake, right?
Also made her debut in Layer Cake.
And he thinks that she's his true love, and he's meant to impress her. And he says to her, I'm going to go get this star and I'm going to bring it back to you. And that will be the proof of my true love, because otherwise she's going to get engaged to somebody else. And that starts his adventure.
And we all know that that's bullshit. She has no interest in him whatsoever. He could bring her back a star and she probably won't.
Isn't her fiance Henry Cavill in one of his earliest
roles? Yeah, young Henry Cavill, too.
Yeah.
Matthew Vaughn actually has a very interesting track record of breaking young actors out, especially British actors. I think X-Men First Class is a big leap for Michael Fassbender, Daniel Craig, like we said, Taron Egerton came out of the Kingsman movies. And here it's Charlie Cox, who people probably know best as Daredevil. But that's still, he's somebody. He's got a Tumblr, people like him.
I think the thing I love best about this movie, and I love this movie, is that Matthew Vaughn wanted to make Princess Bride meets Midnight Run. And I feel like that's exactly what he made. And it falls into the genre of family movie that we don't really have anymore. Like you think about E.T. Like E.T. would be like a family movie where there's stuff in it for kind of everybody, as opposed to being like, oh, there's dirty jokes for the parents, but 90% of this is for the kids. If the kids get the jokes, it's not our fault. That's kind of what this falls into, that like really your kids are going to be like a little bit freaked out by the witches.
This is dark,
but But if they're, again, if they're getting like the bigger concepts of like immortality and stuff, like it's just cartoony enough that I think you could get away
with
it.
I mean, E.T. was dark. Like we grew up with dark family films, and I think this is part of that tradition.
Yeah, and I do feel like as much as there is some violence and kind of weird stuff, no, especially your main characters never feel horribly in jeopardy.
No.
You know, as much as it's about trying to cut out Claire Danes' heart,
everybody is.
she does pretty good by herself.
There's a series of brothers that are trying to kill each other in order to win the throne. Their father is played by Peter O'Toole, another amazing mm-hmm. British actor. And every single one of the brothers, this is, I think, so clever and so brilliant, is that you see all of the different dead brothers, and they look like what killed them. So the one that got pushed off a tower has like his hair streaming off the back and his face is all smushed in the side, but it's not bloody. Again, it's very cartoony. But that panel is just full of British character actors. Mark Heap is there, who's one of my favorites. And they keep cutting to him for his reaction shots because his reactions are so good.
Rupert Everett? Isn't Rupert Everett one of them as well?
Yeah, Rupert Everett's one of the first ones we see die.
I think that was one of my favorite things in the film, is this like rogues gallery of ghosts that are all like... sort of the interlocutors of the film. Mm-hmm. It reminded me a lot of like the Haunted Mansion ride at Disneyland.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's
and
very much
they know what's going on. They're like kind of your only audience surrogate because they know the whole thing. Because I mean, there's all so many twists and turns in the story where it's like, even the audience, you're kind of running to catch up and you don't know. There's all these strands of plot, which I would get why somebody would say is overwhelming to begin with, but then they do tie very neatly at the end, which I think mm-hmm. is another kind of Neil Gaiman thing. You never think that all these plots are actually related till the very end. Goes down to people like Adam Buxton, who's mm-hmm. mostly a radio DJ, who is one of the very funny ghosts. It's a very interesting thing.
One of them was meant to be Noel Fielding, but he was sick and had to pull out the last moment. So like that's the kind of beautiful, like weirdo fun people they were looking for.
Yeah. A lot of Green Wing, the cast of Green Wing, if you like that show.
And we should also talk about Michelle Pfeiffer, because we're going to be talking about her again later in the year of 2007, because she had just come off of a hiatus where she was going to be with her family for, I think, from 2002 until 2007 is the hiatus she took.
Yeah, White Oleander is really the last kind of big film she has come out she's huge, right? Like she and right up to then she's in I Am Sam, What Lies Beneath, White Oleander. So it's like a lot of people were like, where did she go? And it's a lot of her going away is, like you say, it's either family related. A lot of it was she fought very hard to make a Catwoman film that never came to fruition. A lot of it is this film that also comes out in 2007, which I would vehemently not recommend, called I Could Never Be Your Woman, which is Amy Heckerling's film. It was kind of taken away from her. It's one of those weird ones where it goes back and forth. It's Michelle Pfeiffer. Everything makes you want to see it. And I'm going to say, just don't. Michelle Pfeiffer is a mother of Saoirse Ronan in Saoirse Ronan's first film, and she's being romanced by Paul Rudd. And you're like, that just makes your heart glow, but it's not a great movie, unfortunately. So that movie was delayed forever. That's kind of was meant to fill the gap. And it was unfortunately delayed from 2003, maybe. Because think of I Could Never Be Your Woman. That is a song from 1998, maybe.
Yep.
a movie named after a song that everyone has forgotten about. This year you see her come back with that Hairspray and Stardust, and especially in Hairspray and Stardust, back to good villain roles.
That's what I was thinking. And she's also ugly on the inside in one and ugly on the outside in the other, which is really interesting. And with her being like ugly on the outside, I mean, for most of her villain roles, she's still playing incredibly beautiful people. And on this one, she's just covered in prosthetics.
I would forget that I looked like that after a while. And I'd be standing talking to somebody and they would have this expression and be kind of like, and I would be sitting there talking to them, thinking, what's wrong with them? Are they, you know, are they upset with me? And I would forget that I looked so hideous. Nobody ever really got used to it. Even Matthew would always give me that look. And I would always think he's not happy with what I'm doing. And he was afraid of me.
Yeah. I always feel like every time she has a quote unquote comeback, because she's around pretty much most of the time. But you think of something like Mother recently and people are like, hot damn, Michelle Pfeiffer. And again, it's just her coming in for 15 minutes to be so evil. And you're like, Yeah, that's the good stuff.
It's interesting how this film plays with aging and yes. her, because I think when actresses of a certain age, and, you know, Michelle Pfeiffer is someone that has outlived what is the typical expiry date for an actress, mm-hmm. And done so, you know, really well in a way that probably paved a lot of roles for other women who are, you know, over the age of 30. I love what it yeah. does with, because she's a crone, essentially, when the film starts out. Like, she's ancient. She's like 700 years old, and all the prosthetics and the makeup, you're like, yeah. oh, she's aged horribly. And then, like, you know, she progressively, as she cuts out the hearts of stars and drinks the blood of various people, becomes younger and younger. And it's such a, for me, it was like such a tongue-in-cheek kind of nod to how we consume these actresses in roles like this and on film when they've been mm-hmm. away for a while and they're over the age of when they would normally be given roles.
It's a very classic All About Eve thing as well, right? Like, yes. that's very much going on. Mm. As she uses her power is how she starts to decrepit herself again. Like, that's how she fades into herself.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think it's on purpose, but Claire Danes has also played her daughter on film mm. in the pretty big to Julian yeah. on her 37th birthday. So it's like, it's kind of like, I don't think that Matthew Vaughn or anyone was thinking of that. But I think, you know, a certain thin slice of Michelle Pfeiffer fans are probably like, wow, what a reference.
I also want to take just a second to talk about how many boob jokes that I actually think are funny are in this movie, because there's a lot. One of them, there's a young man who gets transformed from a goat into a young woman. And there's like this little popping sound as he gets boobs mm. and he looks down and he's just so excited. He's just like, oh, hey, I got these now. And it's not gross and it's not leering. It's just like, oh, I'm someone else. And yeah. and I think that was really funny. And then there's a moment as Michelle Pfeiffer is losing some of her beauty, where her boobs sag yeah. in like an almost mm. instant drop, and it's so funny.
Sorry, death becomes her.
Not unlike Death Becomes
yes.
Her.
I
feel like has the great boobs game. I also, that goat guy is MVP, and I will say, when the woman playing the goat man as a woman, it is my real MVP of the movie, because I think she is so funny. Can't stop looking at her own boobs, yeah. even in later scenes. trying to not look at nude Claire Danes in
to
later
me,
scenes.
That, very, those very elements are very actor. Monty Python, very Terry Gilliam, which I believe Terry Gilliam was he not attached to this at one point?
Yes, he
was.
Yeah,
he was. Yeah. And he decided to not do it because he'd just done Brothers Grimm. Yeah.
Yeah. Brothers Grimm was a pretty notorious box office disappointment with a huge budget.
Also an ugly witch, Monica Bellucci, slowly becoming young as well, I believe.
It's very similar.
Yeah. I think that's yeah. also the other reason we don't see a lot of fantasy movies, is because they are exhausting. Like, you see yeah. these people who are like, I just don't want to do it again. There's just so many moving parts. But I just want to point out, in 2007, I think you guys mentioned this in the TV series, that this was a huge year for like this kind of fantasy blockbuster. So you got the third mm. installment of Pirates, you got the fifth installment of Harry Potter, you got Shrek, and The Golden Compass comes out this year too. So mm-hmm. it was not mm-hmm. bereft of these kinds of films.
Yeah, and at the same time, you can point to something like The Golden Compass when you're saying, is this a hit or not? And compared to The Golden Compass, this is sure a hell of a hit.
No.
This one also did incredibly well on DVD, like, because Neil Gaiman also has his own like yeah. nerdcore people who really love him. Yeah. I am part of it. And I think that's where people really were watching this and watching it on repeat.
And I think to this day, again, I'm not a massive reader of Neil Gaiman, but I think to this day, this is considered one of the better of his adaptations.
Definitely.
Because he...
This and like Coraline.
Yeah, I think he controls a lot of what is adapted, but it still doesn't quite come out right. Because even something like Mirror Mask, which I think is kind of end-to-end mm-hmm. him, it's not a thing that people really love.
No.
So I don't think it's really mm-hmm. capturing the spirit. I think that there's kind of an alchemy that maybe even he can't grasp to his stories translated to the screen.
I think there's something too, because it's just so much world building that like, mm-hmm. and there's so much yeah. narration that when you really get into it, it's about the world as opposed to the people.
Yeah. Speaking of narration, a wonderful narration from Ian McKellen. Agreed. As a little Lord of the Rings yeah. tip of the hat yeah. too, I think. I think it's like, here's a familiar thing, you know.
It's very, very soothing.
Well, this is one of the few times when there's another movie we're going to be talking about next week where it's also adapted from a novel where they use the narration as mm-hmm. like the novel's text. I think this works better than that one, but this one yes. I found, because it is so storybooky that you're like, hey, I'm on board, and this, and I kind of need an introduction to this world because it's all world building and it's very complicated.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Robert De Niro.
Let's do this, guys.
Sure. I know we're going to, but I just feel like I'm so excited to talk about this character.
Can I just say before we get into the Robert De Niro character, not one interviewer had the balls to ask him why he took this role. And if they had, there's a very interesting story about Robert De Niro that I didn't even know until like yesterday when I went down this rabbit hole, and his history with promoting LGBTQ people. He won the GLAAD Award for his contributions in 2013, 2014, I believe. Stardust itself won the GLAAD Award for Outstanding Film this year because he plays an openly gay sky pirate
closeted gay sky pirate.
Yes, who then is open in the end. Yeah. Yes, who's open in the end and prances around with a feather boa and in a full corset and wearing makeup. And what a thing.
I read that as queer, but I also read it just as like a dandy pirate.
Yeah.
And we kind of have tropes for that character, like a fashionable pirate who's really into lace, but they take it to the next level, which I think is a logical place to go. I was so surprised by this character.
Sure.
And I really loved it. This was the selling point. This and Michelle Pfeiffer as this absolutely evil witch were the selling points of this film for me, which I really did enjoy.
And it's worth saying, too, he partially took the role because he didn't take the Barbossa role in Pirates of the Caribbean and was a little jealous because he was like, that was pretty cool in the end.
Yes.
Jeffrey Rush gets a bunch of roles because other people turn them down.
Yes. But yeah, I think this role is so cute and it's so subtly well done. He's very hamming it up and really locked in. He really is having fun with it, which is good because, yeah, he can do his sleepy De Niro sometimes. But yeah, he's having a lot of fun. And the whole thing is cute because he has his pirate crew led by Dexter Fletcher.
Yes. Can we talk about my favorite Dexter Fletcher? Just very briefly.
Sure.
Dexter Fletcher, who's now a very awarded director. Mm-hmm. Did he direct both Rocket Man and the Queen?
Yeah, he took over the Queen thing from Bryan Singer. He says he considers himself like
barely
a cleanup hitter of that one.
Yes.
But
he should take credit because that's huge. And then of course Rocket Man. But he was a child actor who I know from a film that's come up before on this podcast, Bugsy Malone. So to see him as an adult where he still looks like this bug-eyed child, but he's a pirate. He's very, to me, very on brand with like Terry Gilliam, Time Bandits, Air Pirates, Baron Munchausen. Sorry. That is really the feel of this whole air pirate sequence with De Niro. I think Dexter Fletcher is so pivotal to that.
And he's, he was in a lot of the Guy Ritchie films, and I think he's actually pinch hitting, if I'm not mistaken, for Vinnie Jones, who I think was supposed to be the role. But I think Dexter Fletcher is so much cuter because the whole thing is that he knew the whole time that De Niro was this guy, but they just liked him and they wanted him to be their captain.
Yeah, yeah. The captain has to pretend to be like villainous and he's going to murder everyone.
It's the Dread Pirate Roberts thing, right? Where like the name is passed along. It's this, you have to have that aura of evil around you, but he's got this on the other side of them. And this is so much about it. Again, this is a movie about coming into your own and learning who you actually are and what you actually want. And he wants to live, he would like to live non-closeted, and he gets to at the end when he is exposed. And I remember my mother seeing this in theaters, and she called me almost immediately, and she was in tears. Like, she was genuinely moved by this because she couldn't help but think that she was sitting there watching a movie where people were cheering a character who was cross-dressing and they loved him and were genuinely concerned he was going to be hurt. And she could not think of another time where that ever could have happened. And it was just such a sign of progress for her. She was so joyous. So I get him, which is why this got nominated for the GLAAD Award, because it's like, it's a beautiful, it's a very sensitive betrayal. And Cam, to your point with the hamming, I think it's both Robert De Niro having fun and the character having fun. Like, he's just so overjoyed that he has people to play with.
Yeah, yeah. The whole thing is that he has this beautiful closet of clothes that he never gets to use. And
he just touches.
Yeah, he just like collects them, and he finally gets to dress up people like dolls.
Yeah, Claire Danes gets to get dressed up by Robert De Niro, which is a very adorable sequence.
And he teaches them how to dance and how to fence, and like, he's very much the mentor character. Yeah. But just quickly, something I didn't know about De Niro was that his father was an artist who in his later life was openly gay, but was forced to live closeted for a large part of his life. There's actually a documentary about this, and a lot of his father's mental health issues are attributed to the fact that he was forced to live closeted. And that De Niro, when he was founding Tribeca, one of the founding principles of Tribeca is that it has, it gives awareness to LGBTQ projects, that it makes sure there's a platform
so
for that.
I know his mother was, I believe his mother was also a painter, because when I went to the Peggy Guggenheim Museum in Venice, they have a lot of his father's paintings and his mother's paintings in the collection, which I remember, you know, there was a little like didactic plaque explaining that these are Robert De Niro's parents. And I was just like, that was unknown to me entirely.
Well, we're talking about absolutely beautiful costumes here. We've talked about the amazing closet full of things that Robert De Niro has. And I got to ask you guys, have you guys seen Wreck-It Ralph 2 from 2018?
I have, yes.
Okay. So you know what scene I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. There is a scene in this film that I love where Princess Vanellope von Schweetz, who's voiced by the wonderful Sarah Silverman, is running away from the bad guys. And she ends up in this room full of Disney princesses, like all of them from Snow White to Elsa. Pocahontas is there. And she announces that she's a princess as well. And then there's this whole hullabaloo about, oh, what makes you a princess too? You know, do you have a magic hair? Do you sing with animals? And do people assume, and I quote, this is a line from an actual Disney movie, all your problems are solved because a big, strong man showed up. Just 18 years before the Disney Princess brand was started, and it was there for young girls. It was the advent of the Disney store. And let's face it, I think a lot of women in general really buy into that without evaluating what the messages actually were in these original animations. I think there's been a big revisitation by Disney of what the purpose of these characters are. But 2007 saw a movie that was kind of their first foray into self-awareness with a script that had been on the hot plate since the 90s, in which it was a Disney princess come to life in modern day Chicago, and she was mistaken for a stripper. That version didn't make it to the big screen, but another version did. How did this movie get made? Let's talk about this one.
As you say, Bill Kelly, strange screenwriter, who really only has three credits to his name. They are Blast from the Past, also 2007's Premonition with Sandra Bullock, and this script Enchanted, which really got him what he was after. It was a hot script. It was originally a Touchstone film, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And it bounced around a lot to different directors and different screenwriters. It actually, like, he sold the script. It was pretty much taken away, and other people worked on it.
It sold for $250 million.
Oh, yeah,
like, there
yeah.
was a bidding war over this script.
This is a very well-liked script, and there's just all these different kind of permutations in the development. A lot of the kind of directors you would think, people like Rob Marshall, who, of course, had the big hit with Chicago. The weird thing is it was originally kind of an R-rated comedy. They say it's in the vein of Fast Times at Ridgemont High or American Pie. So I think that there's...
It's hard to picture that.
Yeah, it's hard to picture. There was apparently at one point they really wanted Weird Al to do the songs in it, which I wish would exist. Briefly, I don't know if you guys know, but Jerry Bruckheimer was a very big part of the Disney brand for a brief moment with stuff like Prince of Persia, National Treasure, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, The Much Forgotten. So...
The Nicolas Cage films. The brief Nicolas Cage-essence
of Disney. Director John Turteltaub, who was involved in those, he had it. Adam Shankman, another kind of musical guy, was involved. But yeah, the script bumped around, eventually ended up with Kevin Lima, who is mostly an animation director at Disney. He actually brought back Bill Kelly to work on it again. But I think by this point, it had become much more of a... light parody, but Kevin Lima really wanted it to be kind of a tribute to Disney history and Disney princesses.
Which I think it is.
Yeah, they came together. Yeah, I think it's light on the parody, harder on the we love Disney. That's kind of 2007. But like what we're talking about as well, it's also a real low point, I think, for Disney caring about princesses. Really, if you count the last of the kind of official Disney princess films to come out was Mulan, and the next one to come out would be Tangled. And I think even Tangled, as much as it's a fairly Disney princess, it's an action movie, really.
Yeah.
The whole thing is like Rapunzel's action-y. So really the next, it takes till The Princess and the Frog. And even that one, not quite the same. Frozen, not quite the same. So it's kind of in the middle of this shakeup of what people thought of princesses and a rebrand. And we should say that no official princesses actually come out of this film in an odd way.
No, and nor can it, because they had planned to make Giselle, the Amy Adams character, part of the Disney Princess Pantheon, and then they realized they would have to pay likeness rights forever to Amy Adams and her estate, and that was not going to happen.
How did they not realize that in the beginning? Because I feel like Disney and copyright is a very
there's also solidified. A fascinating like thread, which I think they're like Disney nerds would also have a problem that Giselle is not a princess, that in fact Nancy is the princess.
That's right.
Idina Menzel is the only princess that comes out of this film.
It's such an interesting moment in Disney's history, and we've talked about on the podcast kind of where Disney was in the 1970s when we did British animation. But if you think about 2007 or when this was in production in 2006, by that point Disney had completely pivoted to CGI animation and had kind of let go of their house of classic film animators. So when it came time to, you know, do the first portion of Enchanted is, of course, traditionally 2D animated, hand-drawn animation, although I do think there's some element of computer assistance in this for sure, they had no one to do it in-house. And, you know, that's changed a little bit today, but it's a sad moment. So they had to go to another animation company, which was James Baxter Animation. James Baxter had worked as a character designer in the 90s for Disney. So he designed a lot of the characters in Lion King, and then most significantly, Beauty and the Beast, which I see a lot of Beauty and the Beast in terms of the animation style in the early portions where they're in Andalasia, which is the fictional fairy tale animated town. It's interesting. It's an interesting style, because when I was watching it, I'm like, it is definitely Disney style far removed, because we're so not used to seeing classic animation from this era, from, you know, the late aughts. I don't know. How did you guys feel about it? Like, how did you feel about the early
animation?
I agree.
Animation? I my thing that I come back and forth on. I think this is a cute movie. I think it's charming.
I do too.
Get a kid to watch it. I think it is a god awful attempt at parody. If it thinks it's a parody of anything, it's BS. And that starts with the fact that the animation, to me, I would make it look like Snow White. I would make it look like a
classic.
I think Kevin Lima, you can read, he has a very specific vision of a unique kind of animation, which is not what Disney is like. I think he wanted the faces to be a bit different to connect with the live action actors. But I think, unfortunately, it just like doesn't work, because it doesn't feel like Disney animation at all. Like you watch something like The Simpsons or Family Guy parody Disney animation, and it looks like Disney animation. There's a way to make it look Disney.
Well, I think it's brushstrokes. Mm-hmm. That's my biggest thing, is what Enchanted looks like to me, and this isn't necessarily criticism because it's just how it was historically, is when Disney went back and restored for like endless DVD versions or Blu-rays, when they went back and like digitally restored. And I put that in quotes, and I realized they can see it on Zoom. You cannot see it listening to me, but this is in quotes, digitally restored. You know, what they would do is just like doing Snow White or doing Pinocchio would be automated, and you would get all the hand brush strokes that you would see from these, you know, the famous old men who animated Disney are gone. They would recolorize a lot of the films and make them kind of like, you know, like Dora the Explorer Purple does not exist in 1937. Mm-hmm. And there it is all of a sudden in Snow White, which was never how Snow White looked. And to me, watching the early portion of Enchanted is like watching how Disney has bastardized their own animation by making it look too smooth and too clean cut. And it's interesting because Kevin Lima also worked. He was a character animator for Little Mermaid, for Rescuers Down Under, for Oliver and Company. And then he directed Goofy Movie and Tarzan.
Yeah, which people like. I think that the interesting thing too is this is coming off of an era which I think just now is being reassessed, an actual interesting era in Disney animation. Stuff like Goofy Movie, stuff like Atlantis.
Tarzan. Hercules. Yeah.
And I also think stuff like the same year Meet the Robinsons came out,
which is awesome.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people
these are
like, these are great movies. But it was Disney trying to find itself and going, no. And again, I think it's like, it's interesting. You can read a lot of Kevin Lima talking about what he wanted in this animated visual style. But I think what I want, and probably what audiences want, is a parody of Disney. Like,
yes,
yeah.
Which it's not.
I want to take us back into like what this was originally intended to be and Touchstone and Who Framed Roger Rabbit and yeah. that sort of feeling, because we haven't talked at all about Michael Eisner and what a controversial figure he is yeah. in Disney history, because he was like the Disney Renaissance golden boy. He gave us Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, like era Aladdin. That was like that really turned Disney around, because we talked in the 70s and the 80s about how they were really struggling. So he came mm-hmm. in and like reinvented that whole thing. But then he started to stretch a little too far. He was the one who was like, we're having Euro Disney, which yeah. was like a notorious issue.
I enjoy a Euro Disney. Yeah. I'm just going to point that out there. That's the last Disney park sure. I visited.
I like every time TGIF went to Disneyland, all of his vertical integration of brands.
Totally. Well, he's also the one who started Disney Cruise Lines. And he also started Touchstone, which was meant to be like the adult brand of Disney. So like Splash went through there. And of course, yeah. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is an obvious parallel to this.
I mean, yeah, Splash is a real Enchanted.
Exactly. And Enchanted was bought for this brand. So yeah. One of the reasons why they were so upset with him by the end of his tenure and they replaced him, Roy Disney notoriously like made all these videos pleading to the Disney board, being like, we got to get Eisner out of here.
Hi, I'm Roy Disney. In 1923, my Uncle Walt and my father Roy founded the Disney Brothers Studio, which would later become the Walt Disney Company. My dad, my uncle, and those that followed have created an amazing legacy that has touched people around the world for generations. Lately, though, I've become concerned with the direction in which the Disney Company is moving. I believe it's time to take action, and we could use your help. If you're a Disney shareholder, in my view, the best way to help save Disney is to vote no on the re-election of Michael Eisner, George Mitchell, Judith Estrin, and John Bryson. I believe a new day is dawning for the Walt Disney Company, and with your help, we can bring back the magic.
And they brought yeah. Bob Iger on. It was because he was not focusing as much anymore on the actual like storytelling, and they were kind of getting lost in that. And then that's when they tried to figure out how to make this again. And that's when I think Enchanted came back on to remind people of what they loved about those classic stories.
Yeah,
I think this film is less of a parody, like you say, Cam. Mm. And if you get away from it being a parody, maybe you can enjoy it a bit more. It's sort of coming back to our early portion of the episode. It seems to me to be about mental health.
Sure.
Is that weird?
No, I mean, no, I see it. Fish out of water. We should say it's about a princess coming delusional. To the real world and an evil queen in chaos. I mean, this is a movie that when you read about the references to Disney stuff, I'm like, this is for the real Disney freaks.
It's a stretch.
This is for the people that know the name of every character and the name of every animator.
That
and,
can yeah. recognize the voice actresses on site
oh
of the
God,
Disney
yeah.
princesses, because they're all there.
I'm fascinated
they're
by
that.
They're
in the background on soap operas and yeah. stuff. Like the voice of the Little Mermaid is an actress on the television in a very small scene yeah. in as acting as a soap opera yeah. actress. Like it's so niche that it kind of undoes itself in some ways.
But fascinating. Like, I love that level of yeah. detail. But it's
I do too.
Like, I wish I'd read all those things before I watched it. Because, yeah, no way on earth am I going to recognize all these voice actresses.
I do wonder how much of this... I was thinking about something like Wicked, because so much of this film takes place in Times Square. So you see a ton of Broadway advertisements. You also see a giant advertisement for the film Hairspray, which we're going to talk about later on the podcast.
I think it's purposeful advertisements for yeah. movies that the actors in the films are in, because you also see Superman Returns, which James Marsden is in. And
Very good point. I think about Rent,
which is Idina Menzel as well.
Yeah. And, you know, the lyricist of Wicked does a lot of the songs for this film. And I do think that this is a very particular time in history where, and maybe Wicked is one of the first to kind of take, you know, obviously Wizard of Oz is actually not Disney. It's like one of the only things they have not put their fingers on. Although maybe, did they do Return to Oz?
Maybe.
Is that Disney?
I think they own it now, at least.
Yes.
Anyway, you can look it up, who's listening. But it really is.
What are we, film experts?
Wicked is definitely what they were trying to go for and did not accomplish.
Because it doesn't go
but
far enough.
I still like it. I still, you know what I like about this film is Amy Adams.
Yeah.
Amy Adams, who this is kind of early in her career. Like she had broken out in Drop Dead Gorgeous, I believe in 1999, which is a film that I love so much. Junebug was huge for her. And I believe led to an Academy Award
nomination.
and then Talladega Nights, and then she does Enchanted. This is the film that made her a household name. She was a cheap get in terms of like salary for this film, but she is so charming, and she sings some of the songs she sings herself, some she doesn't, but some are dubbed. But I could just watch her in this forever. I don't know
very good.
How much I love this film in terms of a story, but I just think that she's in the parody.
She
film
doesn't
and everyone else
play
is
the parody. I think that's the whole thing. Is it's 100% genuine. The big giant eyes are all real. She means everything she says. It's one of those roles that only an incredibly intelligent person can play.
Yes. It's also a kind of, if I may get boringly theoretical, it's a kind of plot that I enjoy, which in literature we would call a Baroque person. I always point people to Wes Anderson movies like this. It's about somebody who comes chaotically into a world, and you are, at first, it's about how nothing works with the way they act. She's somebody who's just completely from another planet. The big kind of Baroque man is Don Quixote. And the plot isn't about her learning to function in the world. It's about the world learning why she is correct.
Hmm.
I think that's the thing that works so nicely is you have Amy Adams, James Marsden, Timothy Spall, maybe to a slightly lesser extent Susan Sarandon because she's not given a lot to do. But I think those three characters are so good, partially because it's not about them becoming regular people. It's about them being these outsized characters, but that somehow working in this world.
I think that's an excellent point. See, the thing is, I want to love this film. Yeah. I want to watch it over and over again, but there's just something that holds me back.
I mean,
I'm
very interested in the sequel for that reason. Like, there's a proposed sequel. It's apparently written. All the songs are ready. They're just trying to get everybody together. And I think it could be very good because it also sounds quite a lot like Into the Woods, where this is about happily ever after. What happens after that? Does that exist? Which is kind of what you want, you know? As much as this plot is fun and great for kids, you kind of want to see how the reality of everything would work.
I think for my problem is I love the front half of this. I think there's just so much fun in the front half, especially those rats and cockroaches and like her singing to them. That makes me laugh so hard.
May I interject and say this is a better singing cockroach scene than Cats?
Great. Well done.
But continue.
But I think the back end, the messaging just skews really non-progressive in a way that actually makes me uncomfortable. The idea that like the credit card is for emergency purposes and that moms and daughters shop together and spend exorbitant amounts of money on brand names, in which you see the bags and the brand names. That made
it was Ellie Tahari was the brand that they're toting in, which is an interesting brand for Enchanted to get behind, Ellie Tahari.
Isn't it though? But yeah, that part makes me very uncomfortable. That the divorced couple gets back together and the idea that you have to focus on the good times instead of the bad was like, oh, that's very dangerous messaging.
Yeah.
So there's just a few things that sit in there that just make me very uncomfortable.
I think what you're saying is you kind of wanted this to be more Wreck-It Ralph 2 in that sequence where the Disney princesses are being subversive and laying bare how generations of young girls have been trained by Disney to and young men as well.
And full-grown children, women still stand by it. I've met a number of them. And it's like, nope.
And actually, I think
I was missing that.
There's a very good subversion. They kind of try to do the subversion of like True Love's Kiss and whatever. The whole thing is that she thinks her true love is this prince, but actually it's like a much more like hard-worn attraction she has between her and Patrick Dempsey. But
to a divorce lawyer
who she also has only known for a couple days.
Yeah.
Who leaves his girlfriend of 5 years who he's intending to propose to.
I mean, it's not great. It does Pretty Dirty by Idina Menzel, even though she becomes a princess in the end. This concept, unfortunately, was executed so much better in Frozen, where it's you're trying to find true love to break the curse, and the true love is between two sisters instead of a man.
I think something like this had, I hope Frozen exists because of a film like this. I hope this was just a stepping stone. I mean, maybe that's a good way to look at Enchanted, is it is still only 2007, and that was 13 years ago, and Disney was not quite ready to go full-blown, like, look at how we messed you all up.
And I think, like we were saying, if you look at the following Princess movies, I think all of them, even down to Princess and the Frog, do it.
I love the Princess.
Do it a lot
Frog.
Differently because I mean, it. Princess and the Frog is the princess aspect is you know not it's not as princessy as it's princessy. Tangled, like I say, is an action movie, and it is also about not trusting the guy. Like Flynn Rider is a jerk, and then almost every princess movie since is about not trusting the guy. And
well,
guys being
and
evil.
Then picks. Pixar gets injected at a certain point. Like, this is pre-Pixar Disney. So once you get the injection of Pixar, which has always been a little bit more nuanced with how they treat their female characters, if you think about a character like Jessie
or Bo Peep in Toy Story 4.
Yeah.
Great example. You know, I do think that Disney is more palatable today because of something like Pixar. And I hope something like that Enchanted started with it.
Probably the difference, especially if we're talking about your favorite, Wreck-It Ralph 2, is the injection of women screenwriters. Pamela Ribbon worked a lot on Wreck-It Ralph 2. I think it's mostly credited to her. Jennifer Lee worked on Frozen. I think that there is a difference that you see. I don't think any of the screenwriters who came through on Enchanted were a woman. Maybe there's something there about re-examining princesses.
I can't believe this is a film with Idina Menzel playing a role, and she's very good in this, and she doesn't sing. I know she was supposed to sing the song that would lead into the end credits, which I really wish they had kept. Instead, they went with like a Carrie Underwood song that I think is pretty milquetoast. But yeah, the idea that this is a Disney film with animation and Idina Menzel is in it and has no song
and
to sing.
Patrick Dempsey does, which is kind of wild. I think the other thing for me is I actually don't find any of this music particularly memorable or particularly strong.
Not at all.
In fact, I think it's very telling. It was nominated for 3 of its songs for the Academy Awards and won none of them. Mm-hmm. So it's just not particularly jazzy.
I get
Let It Go.
They get stuck in my head when I see it again, but it ends pretty quickly. Like, I think Happy Working Song, which is worth look up her Oscar performance of it, very charming.
It's adorable.
And That's How You Know are both like very catchy songs. But yeah, reading that it might have been Weird Al, oof. Can you imagine? The Weird Al musical?
I want a different film. I want the Weird Al version. I want this film to still exist and be a little bit more subversive, but then I also want this original version that was like kicking around in the 90s where she was confused as a stripper. I will say that I know a number of burlesque dancers whose day jobs are Disney princesses who go to birthday parties. That is a real thing.
Yeah.
That's a real thing.
That sounds like a great modern Disney princess gets mistaken for the fake Disney princess at a kids party. I think actually, Becky, what you say that you like the first half more than the second half, my gut tells me the first half is more like that original script because that's the cockroaches flying in and stuff. There's a lot more. And arguably she's mistaken for a sex worker at one point. Yes.
All right. Well, I think that is the perfect place to divorce this episode head on out. We're into some more really fun stuff next episode. I'm so excited for this more. I love 2007, guys. There's so many good movies. So that's all for this week. I want to thank Cameron Maitland. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Becky. More James Marsden, Timothy Spall, Michelle Pfeiffer to go. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Alicia Fletcher.
Thank you. Can I give a shout out just to end the episode?
Always, always.
I'd like to shout out Rosalie McIntosh, who was Bianca's wrangler, as well as Carrie Bowen, which was the assistant Bianca wrangler on Lars and the Real Girl. If you are out there, please contact us. I have questions. Yeah.
And we would love to speak with you and possibly high five you once the pandemic is over. Yes. That would be lovely.
I'm in awe. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You can join us again in 2 weeks where we're going to look at a movie where Steve Martin, Robin Williams, and Tom Hanks were up for a role that ended up going to John Travolta. You know which one I'm talking about. And we're also going to talk about zombies and river monsters. It's going to be a great episode. That's coming up in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
Could you tell him that justice is waiting for him?
He's waiting for you. Okay, Justin. Thank you. Bye-bye.
No justice.